So that's a little bit of a overview, kind of a quick summary of some of the issues, and we come back to some of them. And the second topic I just wanted to touch a little bit about is homelessness. And this is work, a lot has to do with colleagues here in Toronto, the late Paula Goering and Vicky Sturgiopoulos, who was at St. Mike's and is now at the chief at CAMH. They did this huge study called the Chez Soi at Home study, and you may have read about it in the newspaper. But basically, this was a study which said, we need to get people's home housing fixed or they're just not going to get well. And so they randomized people to either giving them stable housing first or not and treating them. And this was a four-study, a big study I'll show in a minute. But just to talk a little bit about homelessness, just to see where we are, 30,000 people homeless on any night in Canada. Think about how cold it gets at night here when you think about that. 200,000 people, Canadians, homeless every year. And then again, some of the numbers in Toronto. And again, lots of people with mental illness end up homeless. And then once you're homeless, the rest of your health care often goes out the door as well. You're not able to look after, you're not getting a good diet, and none of your medical conditions would be treated as well. And so it's a terrible, terrible situation. And I think here especially, we can see that around us more than we want. And I know I came in today, and there were a couple of people waiting in the lobby getting warm with all their belongings. And I know you serve as a real sanctuary for a lot of people there, and something which is really important. So housing first, this is the Chez Soi study, was, as I described, trying to get housing stable, and maybe we'll make a bigger impact if we start there. And in fact, this was a big study by the federal government, four different sites, Toronto, Vancouver, Winnipeg, Montreal, and Moncton, and the results are really pretty promising. I seem to have hid that slide. Really a huge impact of getting stable housing first on all kinds of different measures, and it's one of the most sort of biggest effect sizes we've seen for such a really important important topic. Now, let me just move on now to child and adolescent psychiatry, and then we'll get into the spirituality area. So child and youth mental illness, one of the biggest things on campus, in schools, this is a huge topic which is there. Any of you that have kids, adolescents, you know this is a thing that kids are really worried about and experiencing, and it's something that we all are involved with, and it seems like it almost seems like it's getting worse and getting more, and that's a complicated topic, whether we're just identifying it more or we're responding more, but it does seem like the world is a lot more stressful than it was when I was a kid, and it does seem like it just seems like there's a lot more challenges for youth today than there were when I was growing up. It was a long time ago, but it does seem a lot more difficult. And there are sort of main types of disorders. The most common one, what we call the internalizing disorders, anxiety and depression. The externalizing disruptive, ADHD, oppositional disorder, a conduct disorder, and then developmental disorders like Asperger's, autism, and all those different learning disabilities. Those are kind of the groups there. And then, of course, eating disorders, tic disorders that are there. Most of what we see is the internalizing disorders, very, very common. And, of course, ADHD is something that we see a lot. And a lot of it, you know, a lot of kids don't sleep that well anymore because they're up on their phone or screen until late at night. And I don't focus very well if I don't have sleep, but it's certainly something which people are very concerned about and interested in this area. And again, just this is sort of the going back to the DALI that I told you about before. This is looking looking at the commonality, a recent update, now up to 17% compared to 13%. Then we look in young people. Again, I told you a little bit about this already, just the causes of disability. Many of the things that we see in kids are related to mental illness, depression, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, alcohol use. Again, neuropsychiatric disorders making up almost half of the years lost to disability in the 10 to 24-year age group. So something for us to really take advantage, take a look at. This I alluded to earlier, the peak of mental illness. As you can see, there's age on the bottom, and you can see any mental illness, the peak happens with adolescence, almost all of it. Almost 70% of mental illnesses are apparent before the age of 20. It's a huge number, and something that, again, makes it particularly important for us to understand, because these things will often have impact across the lifespan for many young people as they get older. The good news is there are lots of great interventions, and in fact, some of the interventions for childhood psychiatric illnesses are some of the most effective strategies that we have. So there's, of course, lots of different views on the stimulants in ADHD, but the signal when it works is very, very strong. Of course, it's a complicated thing and has lots of side effects, etc., but for many people is a really effective treatment. And again, lots of different therapies for both individuals and for families work really incredibly well. And the good news is that if you're a child psychiatrist, you can make a huge impact, and you can see people getting really, really healthy. They, of course, have to manage having the disorder later, but there are lots of very effective different treatments. And it's not one size fits all. Sometimes it's medication, sometimes it's family therapy, sometimes it's CBT. Autism is a lot of different things that you need to do, and a lot of it is behavior therapy. Really, people have to relearn their internal signals and how they behave on the outside. Educational system is involved, but I think what's very encouraging to me is that there's a lot for us to offer our young people. So let me just kind of move to just a couple of things here about where we're going now. And you're looking at this and going, wow, why is he putting up a ketamine slide? Well, ketamine is one of the things which is changing the way we think about treatment. Ketamine at a high dose, of course, is an anesthetic. At a not quite so high dose is a hallucinogen that people take as a drug of abuse. But at a lower dose than that, it has this rapid antidepressant effect, and it was found by chance. So there's a very low dose of ketamine, and what's really remarkable about it is that it seems to have changed depression, not waiting for the medication to build up after a couple of weeks, but in like hours, people notice a change in their mood, and the mood seems to stay changed. It's almost as if it resets the balance. And ketamine is involved in this glutamate pathway, which kind of, I showed you those neurotransmitters. It's sort of an overarching thing which helps stabilize the function of all of those different neurons. That's a very generalized, my colleagues in my faculty, in my department would kill me for my generalization of that, but I think it's relatively accurate. It's a way of looking differently at the neurons, and ketamine seems to have unleashed a new potential for different treatments, and there are all these different models where you can change the chemical structure of ketamine and find new treatments. So there are clinics like this popping up all over where people might go for a really quick treatment with an infusion of a particular drug, and it's to me a very, very exciting area, and I think there's more to come. There's a lot of tons of interest in brain illnesses, but to some extent there's less interest from a business side for companies investing in new treatments, so it's becoming much more something which is falling on us in the university and in the public to consider. This is a great quote. There's no health without mental health. I think everybody would agree with that. Again, lots of people, if you have mental illness, you're likely to have other illnesses, and if you have other illnesses, you're likely to have mental illness. They really are very connected together. If you have a heart attack, you're very likely to get depressed. If you're depressed, you don't respond as well to treatments. It's all very intertwined. And so we've undertaken a huge project here in Ontario, and I did called the Medical Psychiatry Alliance. And this was a partnership between U of T, CAMH, SickKids, Trillium Health Partners in Mississauga, funded by an anonymous donor, the Government of Ontario, and our four institutions to really try and change the channel on how we treat illness. So we've changed our whole curriculum for medical students, really trying to look at all of these things integrated together, and then we've also really looked at more services that are specific to people in this need, really making sure that we have an early impact. And I think you'll hear about this and see some really remarkable evidence that's been underway for about 3 years, and in my sense is just really getting going and something that we should be very proud of here in Toronto. So now on to the main event, giving you a little bit. Let me talk a few comments about spirituality and mental illness. And this is the area that I know least about here. I have my own views about spirituality and my own experience. And I am convinced that spirituality is certainly an important thing for us to consider and something that helps our people with mental illness to a large extent. And let me just show a couple of slides. So this is sort of a provocative one. This was a debate which was in the British Journal of Psychiatry. Praying with a patient constitutes a breach of professional boundaries in psychiatric practice. And there was a good debate about what does that really mean, and, you have to be careful in terms of trying to come to where the person is that you're trying to help, and I think most of us are kind of open-minded to that right now. But that's, first of all, the important thing. It's not necessarily your own belief. It's your belief. It's the person's belief in helping them access that. A couple of just overall things. Here was a really interesting study. This is part of a 10-year study looking at sort of a gene-environment interaction, looking at people that were off, that were kids of people who were depressed or non-depressed, following them over years to see what happened. And as you can see, the odds ratio there, if you had religion or spirituality highly important to you, you had a 25% less chance of getting depression than somebody who didn't have that. So that's a pretty powerful effect. Attending religious services, about a 60% chance. So Andrew, not maybe just being spiritual, not coming in the door. Maybe it's not coming in the door. That's those are probably highly correlated things. But I'm just, and your faith, what you choose to believe, isn't important. But something about that valuing spirituality, that part, a feeling of that value, really seems to be really important. And I think many people would probably have that experience and believe that to be true. This was another study looking at medically ill older patients, and these were patients that were depressed after being hospitalized for other medical illnesses, and I think the data shows it for yourself. So a really big correlation with your own personal belief of your spirituality and religiosity, which is sort of kind of a weird religiosity to me doesn't sound necessarily like a good thing. It's but I think what they mean here is spiritual belief. And And this, again, is a pretty impressive signal which is there. Here, just to get back to the biology of it, here is, told you about serotonin receptors, and this was a serotonin receptor study using PET scanning in male subjects and looking at their spiritual experiences in the serotonin, and you can see a relationship there between the binding of serotonin and your own kind of spiritual experience. This was used as a way of kind of thinking about how some of these more ethereal things may happen at a more biological level, which may be associated with your mood. And then, of course, there's mindfulness, this is some work, again, which is, again, sort of really bring back the spirituality side into mental illness, because mindfulness works very well. And if you kind of look at mindfulness, there's a lot of similarities between mindfulness and prayer. When you get down to it, there's lots of similarities, this is incredibly effective, and I think now is often recommended to almost anybody who goes through depression or anxiety to consider mindfulness and meditation as something which is really helpful. And just to kind of end off here, this is, again, showing that mindfulness can change the way parts of your brain which are involved in mood might be turned on or off by mindfulness. And on the right side, you can see this red area here, the insula, which is involved in mood and anxiety. And I think you can see the MT versus the controls. You can see that if you're trained in mindfulness, it really shows you, it shows that you can demonstrate here some pretty remarkable differences in the way you might be able to turn on or turn off a part of the brain which is associated with some negative persistent symptoms. And I think that's what people would experience as well. I think in general, my sense about spirituality and mental illness, I guess I would say kind of three or four sort of summary things as we prepare to open this up. So lots of things to commend to it. I think most people would say having a spiritual practice is good because there's something great about having a sense of a locus of control outside of yourself. There's something really very powerful about that, not having to take all the burden on yourself. That's one thing. I think most people would say there's a great structure to a religious practice that keep people well. Most people do better with a regular kind of structure in their life. Socializing as well, really you get a connection, a good social community through that as well. And then again, I think when we get to the mindfulness, meditation, prayer, there's something about that act, that doing, that repetitive act, which is actually very soothing in many ways, and I think it extends to many of the psychotherapy practices which we have today. Certainly, in my experience, it's I would seem that if you did a history and you kind of looked at all the things that someone came in with, and you'd put that in a plus side if somebody has a spiritual practice and faith to see something which is likely to help people get better in terms of all the rest of the things that you do. And I think that would be shared among many people, and I don't have any view that that's any particular faith, but more in general that kind of spiritual belief is very important. So that's a bit of a whirlwind. I don't know if that kind of hit a good chord there for you. I hope it answered some questions. I tried to be informative and not too provocative. I can be provocative at times, but this didn't seem to be the time to be provocative. A big topic, a big area. I don't know, Andrew, whether you wanted to add some comments. I'd be happy to entertain questions or comments that people want to make.